My name is Leonard Lawrence. I am 67 years of age. I served in the Royal Navy and having left the Royal Navy, thereafter I trained as a commercial pilot. My first employment was with British Aerospace, flying the British Aerospace 125 and the British Aerospace 146. What I was not aware of at that time, my employer, British Aerospace, had made a secret out-of-court settlement with East West Airlines and other manufacturers involving toxic fumes on aircraft, on their aircraft.
Okay, well, look, we'll get on to that in a minute. I just
Yes.
want to focus on your background a bit more. So you say you went on to commercial flying, but were you flying with the Navy or not?
No, I was just right at the very bottom of the rung, just a seaman in the Royal Navy.
And these two aircraft you're talking about here, the 125 and the 146, can you tell us a little bit about what they are and
Yes, I can. Yeah.
what you were doing with them?
Yes. The British Aerospace HS125 was a medium-sized executive jet, and predominantly we were doing in-house flying from different British Aerospace bases, and we also used to do VIP flights for certain people like Mrs. Thatcher and others. And the British Aerospace 146 was a four-engined regional aircraft, approximately 100 seats, and it was designed for a one-hour flight. My work there was basically flying the aircraft between British Aerospace bases, and occasionally I used to fly with the British Aerospace test pilots doing flight testing.
Okay, so can you, I mean, which years are we talking about here, roughly?
We're talking from 90, sorry, from 89 to 95.
Okay, so now you mentioned briefly there this business of out of court settlements. So one of the things which you have probably more than anyone else really dug into is this idea that there have been potential problems for many years in aircraft, in commercial aircraft, as well as potentially military, with the actual air that's being brought into the aircraft. It's obviously, most of these aircraft nowadays, or almost all of them, are pressurized, and so it means that you've got to have an air supply which is coming into the aircraft. But one of the things you have come across is that that air supply may not actually be good and healthy. So could you just go into how it is that potentially bad air, which could affect passengers and crew in aircraft, pressurized aircraft, how we've come to the situation where that you would hope, wouldn't you, that in the upper atmosphere somewhere, whatever, okay, maybe not the upper atmosphere, but at 30,000 feet, you get some pretty good air, but apparently not.
Now, this research I know was undertaken by the United States Air Force, and they actually identified there was neurotoxins in the air that you were breathing inside commercial aircraft. They published that result, but it was buried. Then round the,
When are we talking about?
oh, we're talking around probably in the 80s. I can supply you with the information, but in 19 sorry, in 2004, I was quite ill, and I couldn't understand what was going on. Why, when I was in the aircraft, I was feeling dizzy. I was looking at the controls as if I'm not there. Now, what I hadn't known that there was a lot of other pilots like me, and there's a pilot, a British Airways pilot called Captain Tristan Lorrain, who's done a tremendous amount of research into this, and Susan Michaelis, also an Australian pilot. And they made a number of videos. You will see one online, Welcome Aboard Toxic Airlines. But effectively, what was happening, the air you breathe on a commercial aircraft, like the 747, the 777, the Airbus A330, the air comes in the engines, and it's bled off a high-stage compressor into the cabin. But what people don't realise, that air is not filtered. In the engine, they use additives so that the engines can operate at high temperature. And contained within these additives are organophosphates, specifically tricresyl phosphate. When these chemicals are heated, they become far more dangerous and they modify. In an aircraft engine, when the engine seal starts to wear or indeed fails, those oils, those fumes go straight into the cabin. And then people get, like I do, exposed. One of the problems, you think the masks which fall from the ceiling, you think they're oxygen masks. They're not. They are actually recirculated air. So you're actually breathing that air when you put your mask on.
Well, but, yeah, I mean, that very rarely happens. But I mean, the thing is, the point here, surely, is that a passenger may be exposed once, but any of the airline crew are getting exposed again and again and again.
It only takes one bad exposure. There was a flight from Gatwick to, I think it was Orlando. It was XL Air. I believe it was a 767. The Sabatino family was on this, a mum, dad, and their children. And by the time this airplane landed in Orlando, around 50 of the passengers were in the emergency room at the hospital, having been exposed to toxic fumes like I was.
Now, so it seems incredible, Len, that you're actually taking air from inside the engine. Now, what the jet engine does is it's got a, as you say, you're talking about the high-stage compressor. It's got a low-stage compressor, the first compressor, which is the big fan that you can see at the entrance to the jet itself on the wing. Or I suppose it's mostly these days they're on the wings, aren't they? But then there's another compressor deeper into the engine, which is a more powerful one, which compresses the air even more. And what you're saying is there's a little kind of pipe that comes off at that stage, which is compressed air that can then be fed into the aircraft. And of course, it does need to be, I suppose, compressed to a certain extent, because you need to keep the aircraft pressurized.
Yes, if you go online and you do a Google search, aerotoxic or toxic cabin air, you'll be able to search all these on the internet and see very good graphic pictures.
Right. So what was the effect in you? It just sounded a little bit dangerous, especially if you are the number one pilot rather than the co-pilot.
Well, no. To fly a modern,
you know, that sounds dangerous. Yeah.
To fly a modern commercial aircraft, it requires two pilots. And what actually happens? One leg, a captain will fly. Then you will reverse rows on the second leg, so the first officer will take the captain's duties, and you alternate. Now, I was with a very experienced pilot called Ian Gass around about 1990, and we were taking off from Prestwick Airport. I was the first officer, I was the handling pilot, and we had reached a stage called V1. When you reach V1, you're committed. Beyond V1, you're committed. You must take off because there's insufficient runway to stop. And just as we passed V1, the entire flight deck filled with hot, acrid fumes. I was unable to see the controls. I was unable to keep my feet in the wheel well. I had to remove my feet away from the rudders. And my eyes were burning. My skin was burning. And I counted a few seconds, and I slowly pulled the aircraft into the air. I had no visual reference whatsoever how I was pulling these controls back. Then my colleague, Ian Gass, he was amazing. He actually reached across the control panel. He found a thing which is called a dump valve, and that immediately depressurized the aircraft, and the fumes all were discharged. But for around 12 seconds, we were doing about 160 mile an hour, unable to see anything. Anyway, a mayday was declared. we came round at, I flew round at Prestwick and did an emergency landing.
So what was this, a commercial flight or not?
It was an executive jet, the 125. We did an emergency landing and we did an emergency evacuation. But what is particularly relevant to this, on board that aircraft that day was some Charles Masefield, the managing director of British Aerospace commercial aircraft. He witnessed that firsthand.
So what was done about it? And what caused that? What had caused that?
What happened, a valve had become open. There was a way to do an, an emergency pressurization, but this valve had somehow come open. It allowed air directly from the bleed hot engine straight into the cabin. Now, what was done about it? We came back the next day by commercial flight, British Airways, back to London. But the, I think the next day, the senior production test pilot, Captain Graham Bridges and one other, flew the aircraft from Prestwick back to Hatfield, where British Aerospace had a base. And thereafter, the aircraft and all the paperwork was exported to Russia, and that was the last we ever heard of the airplane.
So was there a proper investigation?
Yes. The report the Captain Gass filed, called a mandatory occurrence report, it was handed in at British Aerospace, but it appears not to have reached the Civil Aviation Authority.
Bizarre. But anyway, look, that sounds rather similar to the idea of toxic air getting into the cabin. Is anything being done about this? I mean, the idea, obviously, amongst airline pilots, this anything like this would be discussed. Safety is taken very seriously in aviation, and something would get done.
Safety is taken very seriously in aviation by all members of the crew and the engineers, everyone else, but one of the difficulties, we go into this word of whistleblowers. When people start to whistleblow, all of a sudden, they lose their careers. They lose their promotion. What happened, Cranfield, the government instructed Cranfield University to conduct investigations into these fume events, toxic cabin air. And what was unhelpful was Cranfield University had a close association with airline aircraft manufacturers like Boeing, like British Aerospace, and engine manufacturers. The test was conducted, I believe, on a Boeing 757. When the report came out, they published, they had found no incidents of toxic cabin air. What was interesting, a man called Professor Jeremy Ransden, who had been a professor at Cranfield University, and his expertise was in nano engineering. Jeremy Ransden whistleblowed and said the tests weren't designed to find these chemicals. And I was very fortunate, Professor Jackson and one other professor, Harrison, I got permission and I received a copy of their peer reviews. And effectively, the test equipment used to test for these aircraft fumes wasn't designed to detect them. So no wonder they didn't find any.
So what do you think the motive for that was? Is it potential that maybe they could have been sued for these toxic cabins?
Well, they could have done, but it's the cost to the industry. It would have cost billions of pounds. But what we can't evidence, whether then Transport Secretary Theresa Villiers was told that the peer reviews identified that the testing was not suitable to detect these chemicals. It was all brushed away, all hidden.
Well, I'm afraid it doesn't sound so surprising when you think that every single aircraft in the world potentially might have to have been modified, Len.
Ah, well, if you look around now, there's very, very few Boeing 747s. But what you're seeing a lot of now is the new aircraft, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner. Now, what people don't realise, the Dreamliner is the first aircraft in around 40 years that no longer takes the air from the engines. it actually has electrical compressors on the wings, so the air doesn't actually go through the jet engines, it comes through electrical compressors into the cabin. So the problem there is cured.
What about you? Have you suffered any ill effects from this over the years, do you think?
The problem I had, there was something wrong. I just did not feel right. I was on an aircraft, and as I say, I felt slightly, how can I say, I just wasn't there. Everything.
Well, it sounds to me like you're kind of a bit spaced out. How many times did this happen?
Well, it was happening too often, but more importantly, I was seeing it in my colleagues, colleagues who I'd flown with at British Aerospace. They were not ordinary pilots. They were drawn from the Royal Navy, they were drawn from the RAF, and the vast majority of them were military test pilots. Not only were they test pilots, they were test pilots and they had been instructors and examiners at the Empire Test Pilot School. So these were the very top guys. And I was thinking, how did they ever become a pilot? Because they were forgetting to stop to go through their assigned level. They just wasn't quite there. And I was thinking, there's something wrong. But I just couldn't nail it. Of course, it was happening to me. And eventually, there was something wrong. And my wife started divorce proceedings against me. This is around about 2004. But I was still flying. And I was flying with a man, I forget his name now, but he was a civil aviation authority flight operations inspector. So at the very top, he would check the airlines, all the pilots. He and I was flying. We were coming back from Pula, Yugoslavia, when we were over Switzerland and we were given a rerouting, but we were unable to program the aircraft to follow that routing. And we just didn't know what was wrong, so we had to go on to a heading, and that was resolved. Then on another occasion, he and I were going to Amsterdam. Something happened, we don't know what, but we weren't aligned to the runway, and we descended to 500 feet, not aligned to any runway. And we just couldn't work it out. We obviously overrun. But what we didn't know, these fumes were big. The airlines were aware that these fumes were getting into the cabin. Then I went to see a psychiatrist because I thought there's something wrong. I may have dementia. The Independent Pilots Association contacted me and sent me a video. And it was all about exactly what was going on. The Australians had researched this and they knew about it. Their pilots union did. And they'd gone public. I gave this DVD to the psychiatrist and he never bothered reading it. About 2 years later it was handed back to me. It had never been opened. Then he gave me a psychiatric diagnosis of bipolar. Then once all of a sudden the government legal department stepped in, and that's the official solicitor of the High Court, then I suddenly found myself trapped in the mental health system and unable to escape.
Good gracious. So what happened to you?
Well, the official solicitor that my wife was going ahead with divorce proceedings, and all of my affairs were put into the were taken over by the official solicitor of the High Court. Now, this is a very interesting subject where this part goes. If what had happened to me and my colleagues wasn't bad enough, 26 of us had been tested. We all had brain injury. If that wasn't bad enough, it was the cover-up what occurred thereafter. I was placed under the official solicitor of the High Court and multiple court of protection medical certificates were issued to protect me, which meant only a judge in the High Court Family Division, judges in the Chancery Division, or the Master of the Court of Protection and his designated officers could have dealt with my affairs. But what happened, the government lawyers and my wife's lawyers never disclosed these court of protection certificates to the court of protection. And I was then left extremely vulnerable. And I had hundreds of thousands of pounds of adverse inferences and costs on me because I wasn't capable of going to court, because what had happened, I'd been medicated to the extent that I'd lost mental capacity. I was being given sodium valproate, olanzapine, zopalone, and they kept throwing these psychiatric drugs at me. Psychiatrists were issuing call to protection certificates, but the government legal department were not disclosing these to the court of protection. They weren't even put, so I was trapped. Then eventually my wife got a clean break, but I was still being held and I just could not escape the mental health system. And what had happened, I thought, how do I escape? So I went to the Civil Aviation Authority to renew my pilot's license, knowing it was going to be end up in conflict. And the nurse stopped the medical straight away. She said, you need to see the doctor. She said, you shouldn't be here. Saw the doctor, told him what was happening. And the CAA chief medical officer, Sally Evans, said, get the British Airline Pilots Union to refer you to Green Commander Professor Turnbull, the psychiatric advisor to the United Kingdom Civil Aviation Authority. Now that occurred, I got to see Professor Turnbull. And he looked at me, he said, Mr. Lawrence, I have to go against five consultant psychiatrists. You have to put all your trust in me. But he said, we'll sort this out. What I didn't know at that time, Professor Turnbull was seeing a multitude of other pilots all with the same problems. And I stayed with Professor Turnbull. And the first thing we did, we stopped all the psychiatric medication. That had the effect of increasing my alertness. And I was assigned a psychologist, and she was absolutely brilliant.
Well, hang on then, because I mean, you can get some quite serious withdrawal from these drugs, can't you?
Oh, I went cold turkey, and for 2 weeks I was screaming at night in bed, tossing and turning. A friend stayed with me. Yeah, it was horrific, but... It was determination to free myself of these drugs. And anyway, I was fortunate. Professor Turnbull, of all the psychologists at Capriole Nighting House Hospital in London, there was just two he would allow me to see. And the first lady was Julia. She was brilliant. Well, she was very hard on me. She said, well, you're not here to sort of have a yes or no session. She said, you're not going to like it, but I got to be hard on you. And I hated the sessions with her. But after, what I didn't know, Julia had trained in neuropsychiatry. That's very different to, in the neuropsychology, that's very different to ordinary psychologists. Psychology, psychologist looks at your moods effectively. A neuropsychologist looks at how your brain functions. Then after about the fourth or fifth session, she said, we need to go and see Professor Turnbull. She said, I think you have an underlying neurological condition. And we went and saw Gordon Turnbull. Anyway, we carried on with some sessions. Then I was referred to a consultant neurologist, Dr. Gorman Jamal. He'd done a lot of work on organophosphate poisoning with the Kurds who were gassed by, I believe, Saddam Hussein. And also, I think... in the sheep dip poisoning, where all these farmers were poisoned by sheep dip. Anyway, Gorham Jamal said I had a brain injury. I was then referred to the National Hospital for Neurology, Neurosurgery in London, and neuropsychological testing suggested I had an organic problem with, to what my presentation. It wasn't psychological, it was organic. The British Airline Pilots Association, Christian Lorraine, arranged financing for 26 pilots to have blood tests carried out in America. And the results back from Professor Abadonia, Duke's University Department of Neurosciences, showed that we all had chemical-induced nervous system injury, suggesting moderate brain injury. And we all had the same diagnosis. But what was interesting, so I then had my diagnosis, but what was happening, I was still being held by the official solicitor of the High Court, not allowed access to the Court of Protection. The official solicitor is not allowed to make clinical or financial decisions. That's why we have these Court of Protection judges. Now, Professor Turnbull issued a call to protection certificate to release me from the official solicitor. And he sent that to the official solicitor's office. A few weeks later, Professor Turnbull spoke with me on the phone, and he said, how are you? I said, I'm still being held. He said, what? I issued a certificate to release you. I said, they've never told me. He said, right, come up to my office tomorrow and I'll issue one on the spot, which he did. And I took that to the Office of the Public Guardian in London. The Office of the Public Guardian had no knowledge of me, never heard of me. So I took it to the official solicitor's office and they handed it in, and that was the last I heard. I now know what had happened. The official solicitor's office, presented with his second call to protection certificate, wasn't sure what to do. So they used their own certificate and got that filled in with no reference that I'd been held for 18 months, no reference that I was a call to protection. Got that filled in by a psychiatrist, put their own stamp on, not the call to protection stamp, then finally released me. And having lived in a house worth around $622,000, in fact, he sold for that, but it was actually valued at $720,000 and an offer was made at that, I found myself with £80,000 and homeless on the streets, like around 10,000 other veterans.
Crikey. Well, anyway, I mean, this does sound like a bit of a cover-up going on here.
Well,
it's complicated by the situation with the divorce as well. But I mean, what's the most recent developments in this?
Well, what's the most recent development? That bit occurred in 2006. I was very fortunate that I actually got finally, when my house had been burned down one night, staying a bit like Mark Purdy, who did the OPs. I was rescued by, believe it, a social worker, and she had me referred to the brain injury specialist rehabilitation. And for over 10 years, I've had specialist neuropsychologists visit me at home, and I'm the support workers to help me. And I've actually come through a lot of this and now understand what's happened to me. But about 4 weeks, no, six, 8 weeks ago, so we're now going back sort of 15 years later, someone has posted to me all of the government legal department's internal emails from the period 2004 to 2006.
Wow. This is a sort of WikiLeaks.
It's better than that. Not only if it shows how they covered it all up, how they financed it. It shows what they did when I went to Professor Turnbull, how they were angry because I'd gone away from an NHS psychiatrist or a private psychiatrist. Then when Turnbull issued the call to protection certificates, they got themselves into a real tiz-was.
Why were they so concerned about all this? This is some, you know, what were they saying was the reason why they were, I mean, you know, surely it's up to you who you go to, who you get referred to.
Yeah, but Turnbull, being a military psychiatrist, a wing commander, you know, is a very, he won't be bullied, when he certainly was in this case, and he suspected something was amiss. It just wasn't right how I was being certified without medicals, how my assets were stripped, yet there was no reference to the call to protection. And this is what we've unfolded now. There's two videos, actually. I must tell you to look. We do with the poisoning one first. It's called Dark Waters. You can view it on Netflix. Dark Waters. It's all about the cover-up of the Teflon pans, how deadly that Teflon coating is. That is brilliant. That gives you an understanding a bit about aerotoxic, where these events occur and the lengths they go to cover it up. But more importantly, just recently, there's been a DVD release. You can view it on Netflix. It's called I Care A Lot. It stars Rosalind Pike, and it shows guardianship abuse, how all of a sudden people will be placed under the Mental Health Act, their homes will be seized, solicitors and others will go in a revenue gathering exercise, and these people's lives are destroyed. And that was in what happened in my case. The lawyers were generating £100,000 in legal fees. One court of protection hearing I had in front of a judge at Slough, it lasted less than 8 minutes, and I had a £10,000 cost order put on me. But we now know the judge wasn't a court of protection judge. He couldn't deal with this. In 2013, my case came, no, 2012, my court of protection case came before His Honour Judge Simon Oliver at Reading. But Oliver wasn't a court of protection judge. He weren't authorised to deal with it, but he went ahead and dealt with it. And he dismissed my appeal. Then we now know someone's leaked me in. The Court of Appeal actually sent me his papers. What had happened? Mrs. Justice Porthley, a High Court family judge, had intervened and directed Simon Oliver in February 2013 to send my case to the Court of Appeal. And what Simon Oliver did, he printed off two emails giving instructions for it to go to the Court of Appeal. But on one of the emails, he wrote in red ink instructions to a judge junior to him at the Court of Appeal that my appeal be refused. What happened then, the Court of Appeal, someone has posted me these two emails showing what occurred. So we now, the whole thing starts to come out about judicial bullying and all other aspects.
This is something we've come across in, I think, quite a lot of cases, actually. Over the probably 20 or 30 years, it's been getting worse. And, of course, if nothing gets done about it, it does get worse, these abuses of the courts in Britain. But, look, let's get back to this release to you of various documents which show the way that government has been covering up this toxicity of air cameras. I mean, you can see the motivation. The motivation is, oh my God, we have potentially opened ourselves up here to enormous injury claims if we admit this is going on. Interesting that the 787 Dreamliner aircraft is all, you know, arranged very differently now. Maybe that's what these big companies are trying to do. But anyway, what's happened to all that information?
Well, it's, put it this way, it's not in my house. And 2 weeks ago today, my house was raided by Avon and Somerset Police on the pretense that I've sent, on 15 allegations, I've been sending malicious communications. The most serious of this is that I sent a threat to conduct an anthrax attack. Absolute nonsense. But they came to my house at around 10 in the morning. Three males and one female. I was arrested on the spot and told I'd been on 15 accounts of malicious communication. And they seized my computer and they seized my mobile phone. Fortunately, I have a support worker who helps me. And the way I describe my brain injury, all that I do, I used to do automatically. Now I have to do everything with a conscious thought. So it just takes me a bit longer. And anyway, she suddenly appeared from the kitchen and she said to the officers, "Do you not know he has a brain injury? Do you not know he has vulnerable adult status?" And the whole thing then started to defuse. I was taken to, from there on, they were actually quite pleasant. They took me to the police station in a car with my support worker. I arrived at Bridgewater Police Station. They very pleasant, no problems. I was checked in. I asked to see a doctor. And I asked, I have an emergency number. It's a brain injury identity card issued by Headway under their Justice Project to alert people if anyone with a neurological injury encounters problems with the police. And I asked that the Headway solicitor be contacted. Anyway, I was taken to a cell. My support worker was allowed in the cell with me. They didn't lock the door. Doors left open. A police woman, then later a policeman, sat by the cell door all the time. Again, they were very polite. I was offered food, hot food, cold food, drinks. So they treated me really well. But what happened during the course of this, I'd asked for a doctor, but three people appear, two males and a female. And my understanding that they were mental health paramedics. And I said, I don't need to see a mental health paramedic. I need a doctor. But they were insistent. Then they gave me a dementia test. Did I know what dad is, what month it was, what year? And I'm aware of this because I've had all this testing. Then they wanted access to my medical records, and I said no. Then they said, oh, we think it would be in your interest to see a consultant psychiatrist. I said, I don't need to see a consultant psychiatrist. A man who's authorized by the MOD and by the Home Office that I can talk to is available to me 24 hours a day. I said, I'm one of the few people who had four certificates of capacity to show I'm completely sane. I said, not many psychiatrists have that, but they wouldn't listen to me. Then they disappeared, and I found out yesterday. Well, I spoke to the ambulance service. They've got no record of any paramedics coming to the police station. And yesterday I found out that they'd referred me to see a psychiatrist. Now, who these people are, we're not quite sure yet. But now that we've got this referral's been made, we can now start backtracking to identify exactly who they are.
Okay, so have you still got copies of the all this documentation? It sounds like it's...
The documentation is not in my house. It's everywhere. It's in different locations.
Good.
When I send an email, I was taught to copy it to other people, BCC, and all my... So if my computer is ever seized or everything else, there's copies with other people. They're in America, they're all over the country, and that is what we have done.
Wow, amazing. Also, Len, I have to, since, you know, you're in the aviation sector, we're talking about Boeings. We've had this very peculiar air crash over in China a few weeks ago. I wonder what you make of that, with this aircraft up at cruising altitude. Suddenly it looks like the crew have lost control. The aircraft recovers, I think, at about 8,000 feet. It starts to pull up a bit, and then it goes into a power nosedive, hitting the ground at almost the speed of sound. That doesn't sound like your normal kind of airliner accident, does it?
I can remember around about 1990 sitting in a former Royal Navy C. Dixon all-weather fighter at Hatfield. I didn't fly. I just had the opportunity to sit in the cockpit. This is, like I say, 1990. That aircraft was a drone aircraft. It could be flown automatically from the ground without a pilot. So it could take off, fly, then land. That was 1990. When you look at 9/11, that was many years later. So these aircraft can actually be flown automatically from the ground. Now, I have two friends. One, Captain Dan Haley, who's ex-United States Navy pilot, and the other, Field McConnell, who's an ex-United States Marine Corps pilot. And they have raised this whole issue of 9/11 and of uninterrupted autopilot, where these aircraft can be flown from the ground automatically without pilots. Now, I can put you in contact with Dan and Phil if you would like me to.
I mean, it sounds to me we're talking here about, I mean, it's not even what you might call hacking. It's the idea is that this is almost built in, that this kind of thing can happen, that, say, you know, either from potentially a satellite station or a ground station, somebody can, and I can remember reading an article in The Independent a few years ago where some guy actually made the wings wobble whilst he's sitting in the cabin. He's taken over control from the pilots. Now,
I've read that as well.
It's a bit incredible, isn't it? Which, you know, if you read this stuff and you believed it, you might never want to either fly or get in an aircraft again.
No, I mean, Dan Haley, and there's about 70 other pilots on this emailing list, and it goes into great detail how these aircraft can be flown 767, 757 automatically from the ground. The technology, as I say, the technology was there in 1990 when I sat in that former Royal Navy Sea Vixen.
Okay, Len, well, whereabouts are good places for people to go online? I mean, you've already mentioned some videos. If people want to get clued up on this, particularly this whole idea that there may be toxic air in these aircraft, and I suppose how to just be aware of it and what to do if you think that you may have suffered from it.
Well, online, I would look aerotoxicity or toxic cabin air or aerotoxic association. When you go on through those searches, importantly, go into Google Images because you'll see a lot of brilliant diagrams detailing it. Mm. Now, again, to get to grips to this, to actually see the cover-up, how this relates, not only in say aviation, in other industries like tobacco, you got to view on Netflix Dark Waters and how they covered up the highly toxic Teflon coating in pans. It took about 40 years for that to actually them to finally agree that there was a problem. Then what is important is how we start to look at this mental health abuse and how people are losing their assets. They're not getting access to the appropriate courts. And to view that, you need to read on Netflix, I Care a Lot by Rosalind Pike. It's absolutely brilliant and it is very true. But I've had a lot of help from a lot of people, including the then Attorney General, Sir Geoffrey Cox. I went to see Sir Geoffrey Cox, gave him 10 documents, what had happened to me, and he has been absolutely brilliant to me when he was Attorney General. And when I was homeless again last year, he'd actually intervened to help assist me to find a home. So, yes, they talk about the bad side of him when he's been in, I think, in the Cayman Islands. But actually, the man's very compassionate. And he actually, when he was sacked by Boris Johnson as the Attorney General, Sir Geoffrey Cox asked to be given permission to investigate the judiciary. But that was stopped. We all sort of had dinner. There was three air chief marshals, an air marshal, some generals, and a whole scattering of other people. But 2 weeks later, I got a phone call asking if a couple of farmers could drop in. They got some apples for me. And I said, yeah, sure. Well, these two guys came. They're in overalls, dungarees, and came in. We made them some coffee and they gave me some apples. They stayed for about half an hour, then they left. Then I got a phone call, could they pop back? And they did, but this time they came, they weren't a couple of old farmers, they were from the Security Intelligence Services. And they wanted to view my call to protection certificates. One of them held an equivalent rank for chief constable. But he had this in the military. Anyway, bearing in mind these call to protection certificates had been viewed by the economic major crime unit from Thames Valley, who had been down to see me. They'd been viewed by the organised and serious crime unit of Devon and Cornwall Police. They failed to notice one key thing, that these people, two people from the intelligence services, they looked at them and said, Mr. Lawrence, in 30 seconds, they said, these call to protection certificates are not valid. Not one of them has a court seal on them. They're not valid. And then that's when I went to see the Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, when he had the local constituency office in Devon. I went there and he was brilliant. And he's given me the means to set aside all judgments in my case without the need of a court of appeal. And that has come from the CPS and the Home Office. So I had that. But what I said to Mr. Cox, I said, Mr. Cox, me and my colleagues, predominantly from the military, we will find out how tens of thousands of people are being certified under the Mental Health Act, how the safeguarding policies are not being followed, and who's doing it. And of course, 8 weeks ago, I've got all the evidence. And for instance, you were in a divorce and they wanted to put you down the same route as this, they will get you because it has to go through the Court of Protection, what the government lawyers are doing would get you to get a friend as a guardian. Then they would tell that guardian to apply for legal aid. They would get you to sign the form, the guardian to sign the form. Then the legal aid would grant legal aid. And as soon as that legal aid is granted, the solicitor who organised it will suddenly say, you're not a suitable person, nor is your guardian, and instruct it to the court, to the official solicitor. They will step in. Then they've got all the financing they want from the legal aid agency to do what they think. They get a charge over your house, so they know they can actually run up horrendous fees, knowing that the legal agency and them will get paid.
Amazing. What a cover-up. Anyway, Len Lawrence, thanks very much for joining us.
Fine. Thank you.